Pocket. 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 We deserve this win, man.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to your appointment with Homestand Disappointment. It's the Purple and Black Pill. Hello, friends. My name is Ty Foster. I have been riding the carousel of Sacramento Kings fandom since the early 1990s. Joining me, my best friend, a man who can claim the same, it's Duncan Smith. Hello, Duncan.
Hey, hey. Still above 500.
Hey, you know, I'll take it. Also, I'm pretty sure I've used appointment and disappointment before. Doesn't matter. We're going to stop commenting on the rhyme so much. It's okay. I'm just going to sort of bear my mediocrity. Kind of like the Kings this week.
Yeah, one and two gets it done sometimes, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I'm giving the same effort that they did against these inferior opponents this week. So, Kings 1-2, starting out this long, supposed to be very easy homestand. Cumulatively, we are at 21-18, good for fifth in the West, holding strong in that non-play-in tier of the Western playoff bracket. We are 5.5 behind first place Denver. Looks like those first two or three slots are finally starting to get just a little bit of breathing room, a little bit of separation there. And concerningly, we are only 2.5 ahead of 11th place Utah. So, as always, things in the West continue to be a complete slog. Any sort of run of bad luck, any injury issues like what Phoenix is having right now, really puts you in a bad position. So, let's just hope we can sort of continue on at this rate, because it's going to be an absolute bloodbath the rest of the year. Kings are 12-9 at home, 9-9 away. We sort of thought they were a home team. Their home record is pretty average. Their road record is slightly above average, even though it's 9-9. So interesting. 5-5 in their last 10. As always, the West, everybody is 5-5 or 6-4, except for, you know, the Grizzlies and the Nuggets, who are on a crazy heater. But here we are, still in the same spot. I'll take it.
Yeah. I mean, for what, 3 games above 500? And if we had started the season saying that we're going to stay 3 games above 500 the whole way, win 44 games, maybe we push it to 45 games. That would be a satisfying outcome. Obviously, we want more. Now that we're here, we're bloodthirsty, but we're basically a 500 team at this point, like minus one big win streak.
Yeah, and you know, this season so far has been peppered with really kind of annoying, not quite there, disappointing losses, sometimes to way better teams, sometimes to worse teams. And this gets us into kind of our first segment of the day. This is officially the year before the year. This last week really kind of convinced me that we do not need to be getting ahead of ourselves. This is a team that is not quite ready to take us far in the playoffs. I think we all should have been prepared for that. And, you know, we've said this in the past, that the NBA, more than any other sport, is a very linear league. Like, you have to advance, you have to take your lumps, you have to get into the postseason, lose in a way that's heartbreaking, and grow from there. You almost never get away with skipping steps, and this year, we just got to get in and take our lumps, because we're not ready, really. Clearly, if we're losing games the way that we've been losing games in the last week, we're still building, you know what I mean? We don't want to get ahead of ourselves.
Yeah, we talked about this before. There are teams, it seems like, every season who are just sneaking in on the fringes of the playoffs, and then the season after that they make their move. Phoenix did it with their bubble season, where they, I think, didn't quite make the playoffs, but they won 8 games in a row in the bubble and just barely missed, and then came back the next season and were a full-fledged high quality team. And the Pelicans are doing it now. They had that really fun run, somehow got into the playoffs after starting, I want to say, like 1-12 last season or something. They had a crazy bad start last season. Obviously, it's a different situation. They're getting Zion Williamson back, and we don't have anybody on this team that has his high-end game-changing ability. But, you know, that's what the draft is for. And I think that Monty kind of signaled with the Herter trade that he viewed it the same way, as this being kind of a setup year. He consequentially kept that first round pick from transferring to the Hawks that he gave for Kevin Herter in this offseason. It won't convey until the following offseason. So he's going to get his first round draft pick this year, or at least have the ability to use it as a trade piece. So.
Yep. And speaking of Monty, another thing I kind of wanted to touch on, a lot of the Kings fan base has been sort of debating whether or not we should be a player at this trade deadline. This trade deadline, for all kinds of reasons, is shaping up to be a pretty unique one. Again, we've been into this already, but Tim Connelly and the T-Wolves appear to have genuinely just screwed up the trade market for the foreseeable future, at the very least until the offseason. You know, I read a report that Atlanta is expecting to get like a Donovan Mitchell or Rudy Gobert-esque package for John Collins. And obviously you say things like this to the scuttlebutt press in the hopes that that'll drive the value up. But like, come on, what are we even talking about? And the Kings, I think, really need to be wise enough to not view themselves as sort of one move away from, like I was saying, skipping steps and getting into the next tier of the Western Conference elite, because we have a really good thing going here. You know, I've seen people doing fake trades where we're giving up Keegan Murray and Davion Mitchell for Pascal Siakam or whatever, and like, Pascal Siakam's amazing, but Keegan Murray is way younger, and I think, based on what we've seen so far, Keegan Murray is going to be really good for a really long time, and he's going to do exactly what this team needs for the next 10 years.
Yeah, I mean, being a tall shooter in the NBA at this point is incredibly valuable. So unless they change the rules on him or something drastically changes with his ability to make shots, 41% as a rookie on a high volume, you know, 5.6 attempts per game is not just like, oh, he only takes them when he's wide open. So it's clear that he is an absolute deadeye in the NBA, and that's kind of the most durable skill that the league has. People that can shoot at a very high level from distance tend to keep that as they grow. So the only question is, what can he add to that? What can he do to make his offensive arsenal more robust, or to become kind of a defensive game changer? We've heard that a little bit discussed in the broadcast, you know, the Mike Brown wanting Keegan to step up defensively. Obviously, that would be incredible. Whatever he can do to add to what he's already doing is just going to raise the ceiling of this team.
He's had some moments on defense too, man. He will get some chase down blocks. He'll make some really athletic plays, and he's just a very smart, you know, sort of centered guy who knows how to make the right play. He doesn't really overextend himself. He doesn't overcommit in passing lanes or anything like that. He doesn't do a lot of the kind of young guy defensive looking lost problems that we're used to seeing from rookies. And so I'm totally convinced that with the right coaching and with the right teaching, he's really focused and he's really committed to improving, and he apparently has no other interests in life, so you know.
Yeah, he's got the face of somebody that doesn't become interested in things easily.
The efficiency in the last 10 games has been off the charts. His scoring average has held almost exactly the same. He's averaging 11.7 on the season, and he's had 11.4 points per game in the last 10. But he's doing that on 50.9% three-point shooting, 46.1% from the field. And, you know, like, people have been saying in the last couple weeks that we should maybe have two representatives in the three-point shootout, because Keegan and Kevin Huerter are both in the top 25 in three-point percentage in the league. And, you know, it just really speaks to how much things have changed for the Kings this year, with things being opened up with that three-point shooting. The team identity previously was really just like, pass to Buddy and hope for the best, honestly, from three. And now we've got multiple options. You know, we've been riding kind of highs and lows with a lot of our three-point shooters, as you do with three-point shooting. It's sort of a boom or bust thing, and people, you know, shooters tend to have runs. We've seen Keegan go cold for a while. We've seen Monk go cold for a while. And the game changes a lot when you have that kind of spacing. And I know you were telling me off mic about something you read on Reddit sort of along these lines.
Yeah, there was some discussion today on Reddit. A user there had kind of pointed out that Malik Monk is shooting really poorly from three-point recently and overall in the season. He's at 31.8%. Which is not good. You know, any player that's shooting threes reliably or regularly, you want them to be, you know, at least 36-37%. And even more recently than that, he's like 11 of his last 50 or something. So
yeesh,
his numbers aren't great. On the other hand, the Kings as a whole, like essentially every single player in the Kings rotation, aside from Keegan Murray, who obviously we don't have data for him on last season because he's a rookie, has massively exceeded their normal two-point percentage, which I think you can draw a straight line from how good and high volume the three-point shooting has been to how good and high volume the two-point shooting is, because it just opens up the floor. When you see guys passing it around between, you know, three guys who can hit 40%, it's just naturally going to open up the interior. And the Kings are really taking advantage right now. Like, it's crazy. They're shooting 58.3% from two-point as a team, which if you were to translate that mathematically into three-point shooting, you'd have to hit like 39% of your three-pointers to match that level of efficiency that they're currently getting from two-point. So pretty huge.
Yeah. And, you know, all of this kind of goes to show that sometimes what you're feeling emotionally as a fan is not really comporting with what the numbers are telling you, because like something that I've been noticing in the last week or so is, man, it seems like we miss a lot of bunnies. Like, it seems like we have a lot of opportunities at the rim that are not going in. Are we not big enough or what? And then you know, I hear something like that and I'm like, man, the efficiency is so much higher than it seems. And I guess all of this is to say things are going a lot better than they seem, even when we're dropping, you know, these winnable games, again, to both good and bad teams. The situation that we're in now, I just think really calls for some perspective and some patience. Like, this is a real thing that's building here. This is a genuine contender in the making, I feel. And I feel pretty strongly about that. Like, the way that the roster is balanced, we have some large needs that we're missing that are glaring. Rim protection is one of them. But the Kings are doing such a good job at addressing the problem sort of one at a time, whether it's through coaching or whether it's through Monty going out and finding things. Obviously, the impetus in the last offseason was shooting, and huge success on that level. Adding Murray, adding Monk, and adding Herder went such a long way to change the culture on the court and just change the way that the product looks, that I have a lot of faith in their ability to build on top of this. You know, we've mentioned sort of the Jeff Petrie parallels, but this feels a lot like that, where now we have a very cohesive narrative sort of at the center of the team, and we can retool around that for the next like 5 years. This is a window now where we are beginning to enter the prime of De'Aaron Fox and Domantas Sabonis. And assuming we get Sabonis locked up, we've got a core. It's such an incredible luxury in the NBA to have a core that you know you can count on. We've got a culture, we've got the beam, we've got, you know, a tremendous amount of positivity going for us. And we should not get too bogged down in negativity. To that point, I wanted to review the games that we played real quick because they were very frustrating. They came down to some last second stuff. And critically, there was a lot of contentious feelings about the officiating this season and this week in particular against Atlanta down the stretch. DeJounte Murray. Is that how you say that? DeJounte Murray?
That's how I say it.
Okay, we'll go with it. DeJounte Murray had a drive to the basket down the stretch where he pretty clearly used his offhand to foul De'Aaron Fox on the way to the hoop. Instead, he got an and one. That was very frustrating. Didn't show up in the last 2 minute report at all. Against the Lakers, a heartbreaking loss in a lot of ways. Thomas Bryant went absolutely animal on the Kings. He just dominated them on the boards and was finishing looking like an all-star, honestly. Credit to him, but it's tough to see the Kings keep getting run out of the gym by these, you know, guys who have been considered scrubs in the past. I know that Thomas Bryant's better than that, but still. But down the stretch against the Lakers, another just really, 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 really terrible call. De'Aaron Fox playing really good defense down the stretch against Dennis Schroeder and got called for like a nothing bump. There was a lot of bad feeling about the last three-point jumper that Fox took to close the game. Many people, including De'Aaron, felt that there was contact on that. I thought that was less of an issue than the previous play. Anyway, all of this is to say there's plenty to feel butthurt about when it comes to the officiating, but my attitude is somewhat different than maybe the broader Kings fandom. Yes, I'm very frustrated about it, but this is, like everything else we're working on this year, something you have to build. Listen, we're the Kings. Like, Sabonis has joked about this. Fox has joked about this in post-game pressers or whatever. We don't get respect in Sacramento. That is what it is. You can feel put upon about that if you want to, but we have to build something first. The NBA is a star league. That sucks, frankly. You know, it sucks that officiating is such a subjective thing in all sports, but especially in basketball. And until such a time as the Kings have sort of established themselves as a winner with a year or two under their belt, I just don't think it's smart, reasonable, or efficient to be expecting to be getting calls like that.
Yeah, you can't let it knock you sideways whenever something goes against you that way, because that happens to every team. Now, I'm not saying that the Kings don't get the short end of the whistle more often, but every team is going to be impacted by calls that they don't like, and they will happen less and less often when we win and put games out of reach more and more often.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, if you don't want the last second call on De'Aaron to decide the Lakers game, then don't let Thomas Bryant score on you at will. You know, like, you have to give the officials reason to think, oh, this team, the Kings, they're going to win anyway. They always win. Why would I bother trying to, you know, weasel a foul out of this play? It's just, it not that they're thinking that way literally, but all human beings sort of have expectations in life. And so if you make the expectation from outsiders that you're going to be successful because you do all the right things and are consistent and the results match your efforts, then they're going to give you easier calls. Like, that's just the way it goes. So, and the same thing is true for the All-Star selections. The same thing is true for media attention. You know, we were old enough to remember a time when the Kings had a team that was on the cover of Sports Illustrated, which, you know, at that time mattered. It was a magazine. So that kind of being a league darling is something that you have to earn and keep earning. You know, usually it lags behind by a year or 2 years. You know, for instance, a lot of people want to see Fox in the All-Star game. I would love to see it. I've been voting for him. But if he doesn't get there, the reason that he's not going to get there is because last year he had a down season and the Kings have never won anything with him. So, like, if he was consistently winning, you know, 55, 60 games and putting up the kind of numbers that he did, then he'd be like Donovan Mitchell or something. He would be in the All-Star game. So you just have to wait and succeed. Like, you gotta be a playoff team, give people a reason to think, like, wow, this team really matters.
Yeah, not to sound like a 85-year-old granddad or whatever, but respect is something that you earn, you know, and this team is young and they're taking their lumps. And this season, I've said it before, I'll say it again, taking lumps is the win this year. Getting, you know, through this adversity and managing to build on a positive culture while not feeling sorry for yourself is something that I'm really looking for the rest of the season. And honestly, for the most part, I've been very impressed. And to that point, there was a very interesting article I read this week in the SACB by Chris Biederman. It dropped on the 4th of January. There is an assistant with the Kings who's new this year named Graham Betchert. I think I'm pronouncing that right, Graham Betchert. And Mike Brown brought him over from Golden State, and he's, I forget what the official title is, but he's like a mental strength coach, basically. And I was really interested in the approach that the Kings are taking to this. Coach Brown had a really interesting quote about just sort of mental health in general and his approach to it as a professional. Quote, "A lot of times players get looked at as these robots who aren't even human, who are above being human. So to try and help them in that area, like any other business out there does, to me was a no-brainer. And it was something that I pushed for right away from day one." I just find that incredibly impressive. I think that there's a lot of things that a lot of sports teams leave on the table in terms of the human element that the NBA is really far ahead of every sport on. And I just think that it's such a smart thing to invest in the wellness of your people in any business, but again, especially in something like this that is so high stress, that involves such a strange lifestyle, weird sleep schedules, and young people who might not know that they're dealing with something like this. Full disclosure to the listener, I have a chronic mental illness called bipolar 2 disorder. It is a huge pain in the ass. I have learned how to manage it sort of disastrously over the years, but it's something you can deal with once you kind of have a grasp on it. And for young people who may or may not be dealing with anything that serious, but even just dealing with the stress and the panic of being, you know, on display in front of millions of people for your job when you're 23 years old, it's a lot for them to deal with. And so I just think it's really cool, not just as a person who deals with mental illness, but just as like a reasonable consumer of this stuff who wants to see things be more normal for these guys, who wants to see things just be treated in a more humane way in general. I was really, really, really interested in this article and sort of happy to see that the Kings culture is integrating this as part of what it's doing.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It seems like a no-brainer to, if you're going to spend, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in salary to have a player on your team, you should give them not just the best physical training that they can get, you know, strength and conditioning and nutritionists and whatever else, but also the mental health support. Just, it just makes sense, you know, and it goes beyond medicine or psychiatry, or, you know, it even for people who are totally on top of that stuff, having the resources and a plan as a team to support one another in that way, it seems really like this is something that the whole league must want to do. So I'm glad to hear that Coach Brown and that the organization is putting it at the forefront. Even if there is a publicity aspect to it, I'm sure that every team over the Kings' non-playoff losing streak has had some kind of article that came out that was talking about how good the vibes are going to be this year or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're just a little bit better, so we can have that conversation mid-season instead of only having it in the preseason. But even if that's the case, you know, it's, you have to pay these things forward. So it makes me happy that they're doing this work now, because when they are in really stressful situations, you know, deep in the playoffs, and somebody makes a mistake or something, you know, an adverse circumstance happens, they're going to be able to lean on what they were doing this season to build that sort of trust between each other and trust in themselves in the mental game.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's 25, 30 years ago, everybody was talking like it was some insanely exotic thing that Phil Jackson was encouraging his team to meditate. You know, people couldn't believe that he would do such a hooky-booky thing.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, it worked out pretty well. And he created a very devoted adherent in Kobe Bryant, for one example. But, you know, it makes sense that this would... It's surprising to me that it's taken this long to kind of trickle into the broader NBA ecosystem. But it makes sense that people would want to take tactics from the greatest coach of all time and try and fold them into what they're doing.
Yeah, and that's not to mention, you know, a person like John Wooden, who's, I think, a lot of people consider the most successful basketball coach of all time at any level. And, you know, his attitude was always like, we start with training them on how to tie their shoes properly. And I think that is, you know, obviously that's not strictly a mental health thing, but it shows how much the approach is about, like, let's figure out how to make the whole human successful, from, you know, the soles of your shoes to the tippy top of your brain, rather than just being like, okay, let's drill, you know, how to make 40% of our three-point shots. That matters, but like, it's all for nothing if the person is having a meltdown mentally.
Totally. And, you know, I feel like in sports in general, you know, an athlete would be able to speak to this a lot more accurately than I would, but just from my perspective, it seems like there's a lot of negative reinforcement, and maybe that works for some people, but it clearly doesn't work for everyone. And what people like Wooden are trying to do is make things very simple and just focus on building good habits, building healthy habits, building repeatable habits that lead to success. Wooden obviously created a factory that was untouchable for like 20 years in college sports, and, you know, is now recognized as the greatest coach of all time because he kept things very simple. I mean, it helps to like have Lou Alcindor on your team, obviously, but keeping things simple in a game that is as complex as basketball is huge. And playing the mental game in an intelligent way makes a lot of sense, and focusing on it the same way that you focus on your strength training regimen makes a lot of sense. And speaking, as we were earlier, of, you know, a tendency in the NBA to get distracted by how inconsistent the officiating can be, Graham Betchert, this assistant that we're talking about, had an interesting quote along those lines as well. He said, quote, "If you've noticed around a lot of sports, there's this reaction where people put their palms up when something doesn't go their way or they perceive some sort of adversity. It's about being really mindful and choosing your response to these situations," close quote. And that's referring to a thing, this policy that they have, which is, you know, maybe a little corny or whatever, but it's called the palms down approach, where instead of going to the refs with your palms up, supplicant and begging, you're keeping your palms down, you're making your case if you need to do that, but you're not sort of treating yourself as this victim. And again, Those are very small things, and that specific thing may or may not matter. But taking a mindful approach to these things, I think in a game like basketball, where the margins can be very small, as we've seen throughout this season for the Kings, and limiting your tendency or your desire to give into the emotion and make more mistakes, I think, again, it's not about this year. It's about building on that. And as we get into more and more high leverage situations, hopefully in the coming seasons, in the playoffs or whatever, I think that it would be very surprising to me if we did not see some positive return on focus like this. I try hard to be strong, but sometimes I feel my sin. And after all I promised you, so faithfully you And finally tonight, one last thing this week that I thought was really fun is Kevin Huerter had an appearance on the Low Post podcast, the classic grandfather of all NBA podcasts, Zach Lowe, the man himself. Huerter is just a really, really great media figure. He's very candid, but he's very, very chill. He has a really cool way about him in post-game pressers and on the mic. And he had several fun things to say, but the main thing that just endeared him to me literally forever, Kevin Huerter, I hope, never buys a drink in Sacramento again based on this one quote alone, which was he was telling Zach Lowe that he somehow tripped down a YouTube rabbit hole of 2002 Western Conference Finals conspiracy theory videos, and that he was like up till 2 a.m. just like getting his mind blown by this. And I was like, oh my God, one of us, one of us.
One of us. One of us, gobble gobble, gobble gobble. One of us, gobble gobble, gobble gobble. One of us.
He's really like getting indoctrinated into the whole, you know, like us against the world, Sacramento cowbell mentality. He seems really, really all in on just general Kingsness. Very Brad Miller energy, just coming into this ready to steepen it. You know.
Yeah, you know, I've watched some of those YouTube clips of 2002 and other Kings Golden era games, and they're hard to watch. I mean, it's splotchy. You can't make out the number on the back of the person's jersey. It's not beautiful stuff. So the fact that Huerter is at 2 a.m. trying to decipher, you know, which smudge is a foul and which smudge is not, I love it. I mean, mad respect to Red Mamba.
He also posted something on Instagram recently. I forget after what game. It was after, oh, it must have been after the Utah game where he went crazy. He just posted like a series of photos on Instagram of like him playing in the game. And his caption was just sports. And I was like, this man fucking rules. This is the coolest guy alive.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, how will the people know if you don't describe?
How will they know? Yeah, we got to know what topic we're looking at online. Otherwise, we can't. The algorithm will never know where to send us next. Anyway, that just about does it for us. Kevin Huerter, come on the pod. Speaking of which, we've got some really exciting guests coming up. We can't wait to tell you about. We're working on some new segments. This show is growing. It's 2023, baby. We are moving on and up in the world. Coming up for our boys, Wednesday, that's tonight when this posts, January 11th, playing Houston at home. Friday, on the 13th, we got Houston again. Sunday, the 15th, we are at San Antonio. Listen, I've just spent an entire episode tempering expectations and talking about how we got to take our lumps, but we really need to win all of these games.
Yeah, Houston, San Antonio, that's 3-0. Let's do it.
Let's fucking do it. You better get this beam lit three times before we talk to you again. That is it for us. Thank you so much for listening. Please hit us up in the mailbag, purpleandblackpill@gmail.com. That's purpleandblackpill@gmail.com. Hit me up on Twitter and Instagram at purpleblackpill. That's at purpleblackpill. I will be your friend. I will refollow you. We will see you next week. So long, my friends. Bye-bye.
Peace, y'all.